very much. I appreciate this opportunity to talk about a subject that we've dedicated over 10 years of our collective careers together to. And what I hope to do is help folks understand that that carbon is, as we consider carbon from biomass, to be a very valuable commodity that needs to be used intelligently to maximize the beneficial impact. So if I could have the next slide. So what I'll do is just this brief overview is give an introduction to who we are, the fundamentals of a biorefinery, talk about the process demonstration unit we have here in North Carolina, and then talk about commercial plants that are in operation and that are in plan so that we can understand the good examples of a thermochemical biorefinery. I'll spend most of my time on the last slide that talks about the efficient utilization of biomass. Next slide, please. So just an overview of TRI. We were formed in 1996, and fundamentally we have a steam reforming gasification technology that's been developed with over $50 million of R&D investment. We have a state-of-the-art pilot facility here in North Carolina. It is the third pilot plant that we've built. As the technology becomes more and more sophisticated, we've improved our pilot facilities. We've been proven already at commercial scale on black liquor, a byproduct of the pulp paper industry, and we're commercializing two integrated biorefinery projects with DOE support, with projects in Wisconsin. Next slide, please. So fundamentally, an integrated biorefinery is one, if you look at the left side here, we focus on using forest residuals and agricultural waste. We do not want to compete with the high-value uses for wood, like in wood products or in pulp and paper. What we want to do is focus on getting the discarded residuals or that come either from the process of using the wood or that are typically left as slash in the forest. So focusing on those kind of feedstocks, we go to a gasifier, and from the gasifier, we go to a synthesis or a gas to liquids process and produce renewable energy. And that's a very well understood track there. But when you integrate it with an energy host, like a pulp and paper mill, then you start to build on efficiencies and where the overall energy efficiency can be much higher. And I'll elaborate on that a little bit more. In addition, you can also produce char. And the char can go back to the agricultural land as a way of enhancing them and improving the sustainability of this whole chain. We have next slide, please. So fundamentally, the gasification process is, we like to call it, it's like a 10-pound hammer. It just breaks the biomass complex molecular structure up into very simple hydrogen and CO. And then we recombine that in a number of ways to make the catalytic process or fermentation processes to make valuable products like fuels or chemicals. So in our technology, because we're not a pyrolysis or a partial oxidation technology, we're actually a steam reforming technology. We take carbon in the biomass and steam and apply endothermic heat to make the hydrogen CO. Next slide, please. So this is what we call our optionality diagram. So when you start with biomass in the top portion of that diagram and you go to the gasifier and you have syngas, you now have a wide range of options. You start on the left-hand side. You could choose to simply burn the syngas in a boiler to make steam and power, but that's a very low-value use and low-efficiency use of synthesis gas. Next higher on the value chain would be power generation into gas turbines, because the synthesis gas can be used as a gas for gas turbines, or it can go into, because we make hydrogen with synthesis gas, it can go into fuel cells. The next higher value is in hydrogen, where hydrogen as a chemical has very high values. or methanol, Fischer-Tropsch, and ethanol. And you can see all we're trying to do is show as examples the wide range of products can be made from synthesis gas. And this is important because when you make an investment in the biorefinery, and these are very large capital investments, if you start out on day one, let's say making Fischer-Tropsch diesel and gasoline, and 10 years down the pike, there's some chemicals that for some reason have a higher value, then all you need to do is change the back end of your biorefinery, the synthesis plant, and swing it over to producing power or to producing chemicals, because the whole front end, the whole biomass collection and feed system, the gasification, the gas cleanup system, all that stays the same, and now you have the option to make other products from that fundamental syngas. This is a highly valued characteristic of gasification that investors like to see because it ensures a long economic life of the gas. Next slide, please. So fundamentally, what you want to do is you want to have, in the center, I show a gasifier as just an example of what a biorefinery would be. But in the case of our gasification technology, we can process forest residuals, agricultural waste, energy crops. We can process RDF, sludges, and low-rank coals like lignite and sub-bituminous coals. So you have a wide flexibility in feedstock, and if you couple that with product optionality, like I show on the right, where you can make chemicals, fuels, power in a multiple number of ways, then you have what is necessary to optimize the value of the biomass that you are bringing in. Next slide, please. So just I'll just take a second. The particular attributes of steam reforming are such that we produce a high-quality, medium-calorific syngas. Because we're not burning any, like a partial oxidation gasifier, we're more like a chemical process where we're converting the biomass to hydrogen and CO without burning any in the gasifier. And so we have our own proprietary way of providing that endothermic heat, but this is what gives us the flexibility to process a wide number of biomasses and make a very hydrogen-rich synthesis gas from them. Next slide, please. So to give you an idea, these are the feedstocks that we've actually tested to date. On the solid biomass side, you, of course, have wood residuals, chips, and sawdust. And right now I'm at the pilot plant, and we're in the middle of a campaign where we're demonstrating woody biomass all the way from the biomass received to Fischer-Tropsch diesel and waxes being made. But we've done agriculture residuals, things like swine waste, poultry litter, rice hulls, and you can read the list there. Switchgrass pellets and switchgrass. Actually, after this woody biomass trial, we're going to be transitioning over to switchgrass. And we've also tested low-rank coals like lignite and sub-bituminous coal. On the waste side, you know, RDF that comes from MSW as well as sludge are both feedstocks that we've tested. And then the whole range of spent liquors that are characteristic of the pulp paper industry are good feedstocks for our particular technology. And I want to reinforce that these feedstocks we can actually use on the go. You don't have to go through and make modifications to the equipment. You can design in the ability to handle a wide range of feedstocks. Next slide, please. So let me talk a little bit about our process demonstration unit here in Durham, North Carolina. It's located at Southern Research's Clean Energy Development Center. And it is capable of processing 4 dry tons per day of biomass. So it's a good-sized facility, not a little laboratory facility. It stands about 3 stories tall and 50 foot by about 100 feet in footprint. It starts all the way with biomass feed, goes through biomass gasification, primary syngas cleanup. We compress it, and then we do secondary gas cleanup. And we feed it into a Fischer-Tropsch system. So we can even though we're capable of doing Fischer-Tropsch now, we have other plans to bring other conversion technologies in, like a gas turbine and other catalytic processes to send our clean syngas into to make other products. Next slide, please. So this is what it looks like. And if you look in the very center there, you'll see a person standing. And that gives you a feel for the scale of our pilot plant. And starting on the right side, that is our biomass gate system. Our gasifier, our steam reformer, is the next circle over. Then there's our carbon trim cell. We use the carbon trim cell and the steam reformer to be able to deliver the hydrogen to CO ratio that you need for your synthesis step. But there's some synthesis steps need a 1-to-1 ratio, others need a 2-to-1 ratio, and our technology is capable of yielding whatever hydrogen CO ratio you need. The next envelope over is the gas cleanup, and then on the far left, in the blue, you see our compressor, and that tall tower there is the Fischer-Tropsch reactor. I just want to point out that Fischer-Tropsch reactor is a full commercial-scale reactor. The tubes are exactly as long as you would find in a commercial Fischer-Tropsch plant, and so it's just a matter of scaling it by increasing the number of tubes. So this pilot plant, we're running demonstrations, fully integrated demonstrations for the Department of Energy that are necessary to support over $130 million of grants that have been given to two projects that I'll talk about in a few minutes. Every single process step that is in a commercial biorefinery is in this pilot plant, so it's completely replicated here at the pilot. Next step, please. So if you look at the bottom right corner, you'll see a little vial of the wax that we make and the diesel fuel we make and the biomass that we're processing. We've got over 6,000 hours of time on the gasifier and the biomass feed system, and we're almost at 1,700 hours of integrated operation. That means that's many hours of feeding biomass and FT liquid stripping out the back. Next slide, please. Talking about our commercial project now. Well, this one is the plant that we have in Canada at Naranpak. It does 1,500 tons a day of spent liquor solids, which is equivalent to 500 tons a day of solid biomass. The picture there on the right just shows the paper mill, and that circle it shows the commercial steam reformer that we have in there. Next slide, please. We have two commercial-scale biorefineries in development. One is with Flambeau River Papers. That's a 1,000 dry ton per day forest waste biomass facility. It's got an $80 million DOE grant. And we'll be making 9.5 million gallons of diesel, 7.5 million gallons of paraffin per year, and 5.3 megawatts of green electricity. Plus, we're also providing steam and hot water to the paper mill so that they can take their fossil fuel boiler out of service and make the paper mill fossil fuel free. Next slide. In Wisconsin,
sorry,
the second project.
Can you just speak just a little bit louder? Can you speak
sure.
just a little bit louder? Thank you.
Okay, is that better?
That's significantly. Thank you.
Okay. We also have in Wisconsin at the New Page Corporation. That picture there shows that is a much larger mill, state-of-the-art, one of the flagship mills for the New Page Corporation. We have another project that is almost identical, except that it's half the size. It's 500 dry tons per day of waste wood biomass. And in that case, we're making 8.5 million gallons of Fischer-Tropsch liquids and 180 million BTUs per hour of steam and hot water to the paper mill.
Hmm.
Next slide, please. So just to summarize what you have seen, in the integrated biorefinery, you want to be able to handle diverse feedstocks, to make to a wide range of projects and when you integrate it with the energy host for maximum efficiency. So next slide, please. I'll show you. If we go back to the original diagram I showed you, this one shows that the blue lines and the black lines show the typical or the traditional flow of products. You get the waste residuals going to the gasifier, going to synthesis to make renewable fuels and power on the right. You have the good wood going to the pulp and paper mill to make paper on the top. And in green there, I show what we're doing is we take the waste products from the synthesis reaction. It's called tail gas. We take that tail gas and we recirculate that to the gasifier to provide our endothermic heat. So we're maximizing the efficiency of the production of biomass into fuels and doing that. In addition, we take both the gasifier and the synthesis step have some exothermic aspect to it. We take that waste energy and we send that to the pulp mill. And so when you integrate these processes, both the gasifier, the synthesis, and the heat sink, you can achieve overall thermal efficiencies of 65 to 75%. Those are astoundingly high thermal efficiencies, and those help the pro formas perform better. The economic performance perform better. Next slide, please. So this had some animation that's hard to understand it, but basically some investors say, well, what happens if the paper mill goes away for whatever commercial reasons? Well, what we explain to folks is if you have built this and you're integrated with a paper mill and it goes away, then you just simply replace the heat sink with power generation, and instead of sending the steam and hot water to the paper mill, you send the steam and the synthesis gas or tail gas, and you make green power instead of making paper. So the overall efficiencies are maintained. Next slide, please. So let's talk about sustainability or the best use of wood. The biomass is finite, and the sustainable manufacture of biomass is even more so. Now, there's estimates that are varying widely about how much biomass there is, and there's a lot of debate about what does it mean to be sustainable. And in general, growers are conservative. They need to be conservative because their livelihoods depend on it. So what we need to focus on is biomass, our use of biomass, so that we maximize its economic. And if you look at biomass, the value hierarchy starts at the top with wood products and paper, and then chemicals, fuels, and at the very bottom, thermal energy. So keep that in mind. And there are studies that show that when you take a ton of biomass and you push it through the pulp and paper industry, the economic impact to the region is 8 to 10 times higher than if you took that same ton of biomass and burned it to make power. That's a huge difference, and that's something that needs to be kept in mind when we consider what the best use of biomass is. So when you start to consider policy for the maximum economic value on a sustainable basis, you know, what are the goals? Are distributed biorefineries something that we want for rural benefit? Or do we want to pyrolyze the wood in the forest and send the pyrolysis oil to refineries on the Gulf Coast, which will, in general, minimize the rural benefit of biomass? And then there's the whole debate about, do you want to make fuels or chemicals or power? You know, what do you want to incentivize? And that's where the incentives play. And the policies that we target are also important. Are there any unintended consequences? For example, RPS standards that are being considered could have the unintended consequence of incentivizing legacy coal-fired plants to burn biomass. Now, what happens there, as I already said before, burning biomass at a low-efficiency boiler to make power has one-tenth the economic benefit of using biomass for either products or chemical fuel. So if we incentivize the power industry to move to woody biomass, they may then take the woody biomass from the market. And there's a study done by Professor Apt at NC State, who has shown that, for instance, in the state of North Carolina, by implementing the RPS standards, the cost of wood would go from under $90 per ton to over $230 per ton, and that the power generation industry would take half of all the biomass that is currently going to pulp mills and wood products mills, so that the economic impact of that, you can imagine, is going to be dramatic to the state in a negative fashion. And the utilities don't care what the biomass costs, because if they're reacting to RPS, they just simply pass on the cost of that biomass to the ratepayers. And if that biomass is now costing over $200 a ton and it's being paid for by ratepayers, there is no way you'll ever build a biorefinery industry in the city. So my last bullet just there just says that the intelligent use of carbon will define how negative it really is and what kind of economics it brings, what kind of economic benefits it brings to the nation. Last slide.
We're actually going to hold on questions till the very end of the presentation.
That's fine.
But thank you very much. And John?
Yes, thank you, Dan. Richard, if you'd like to begin, this would be perfect time.
Yes, thank you, John. Welcome to the NC Farm Center. We're going to shift, I think, quite drastically to sort of the ground scale of the agricultural use of one of the outputs that Dan was talking about, and that of course is biochar. We are a not-for-profit, and we work very closely with North Carolina farm owners, and in particular Sharon Valentine, who's the owner of Privateer Farm, which is located near Fayetteville, North Carolina, and that is the location of our biochar demonstration project. The NC Farm Center's interest in biochar was really sparked in 2009 by a USDA Conservation Innovation Grant that will allow us for 3 years to evaluate biochar as a soil amendment to improve soil conditions. And we have a extremely challenging soil quality aspect, because we are testing biochar on extreme sandy acidic soils typical of the eastern North Carolina coastal plain area. And we purposely chose that sandy infertile soil quality in order to test the amendment aspects of biochar. Particularly, we're looking for improvements in soil conditions that would result in higher agricultural production, and we are testing the soil amendments on typical row crops such as winter wheat, soybeans, corn, and cotton. And we also are interested in evaluating biochar's impact, again, on sandy soils to very much improve the water holding capacities. As you can imagine, the sandy soils do not have almost any retention of water. They rainwater infiltrates very rapidly. So we're looking primarily at both the production yield increases effects of biochar, as well as possible water retention aspects that would result from biochar. All my slides are going to be real work that we're conducting on Privateer Farm. So my purpose is to give you as much as possible, even a visual feel for farm use of biochar. Next slide. The NC Farm Center on Privateer Farm is devoted to demonstrating sustainable farming and forestry management practices, and I just wanted to give our audience a sense of some of the other sustainability efforts that we work in partnership with the Privateer Farm group, and we also are working on a second farm in terms of our biochar demonstration project. So these are some of the other areas of sustainability that we are all eagerly pursuing. Next slide. The next slide, please. Thank you. This is a small-scale portable unit that the NC Farm Center obtained in preparation for implementing the evaluation of biochar. It's one of the very few portable units available in the United States, and as a matter of fact, this was the first prototype unit ever used on a farm. One of the key questions that one asks in terms of this type of scale, which of course is much different than our previous presentation, as you can see. Again, our purpose is to actually use on-site or on-farm feedstocks, which was one of the reasons that we were interested in this type of technology. We knew that we had a goal to use our own residual wood that's and timber that's rather typically wasted, often just fired. And so we collected that primarily from our loblolly pine stands and converted it into wood chips, which we use in this machine. This is an example of a what's called a continuous process machine, meaning that you can actually continually feed your feedstock and keep the machine running, for example, during a complete 8-hour farm work or 10-hour farm work day. The other type of machine is what we would, at this end of the scale, is what we would call a batch machine, and that is a much lower output, but it's much simpler and less complicated in a way, and it would actually require a manual feeding or a batch load of feedstock. Again, each time you sort of fired up this is a pyrolysis process, the machine. So that's sort of the basic difference at the low end of the scale is whether you choose to go into a little more sophisticated continuous or the more manually operated batch type of small scale machine. To the right, you can see that this is something that we are still experimenting and demonstrating with. We're at the very early phases, and you need to know a lot about the feedstocks that you're using. They can produce very different qualities of biochar, and you also need to analyze the output, the final biochar, as to evaluate whether it's really suitable to incorporate in the soil as a soil amendment. Of course, we're very interested in biochar's soil amendment properties because we hope that in some respect that might replace chemical fertilizer agents. And we also think that if biochar is seen as a very suitable, successful soil fertilizing agent, it will also leverage other opportunities for farmers in agriculture to get involved in carbon sequestration to improve greenhouse gas emissions, and even interest in the biofuels aspects that Dan talked about. But right now, it's still a very early market, and farmers or buyers have to be extremely cautious about purchasing equipment and about incorporating biochar as a soil amendment. Next slide, please. We also, as a demonstration for biochar, look at applications, and this is one example of a promising piece of equipment to incorporate biochar into the soil. It's called a subsurfer. It actually bands or knifes the biochar material at the front end there into the soil without any real soil surface disturbance, and it actually knifes the biochar approximately 8 to 10 inches into the soil. This might be an emerging technology that would go hand in hand with the small-scale biochar production unit. And again, we've tested this on privateer farm. Next slide, please. This is an example of one of our biochar test sites. It's one that is more of a research design of 20 by 30 square feet blocks where we incorporate biochar into the soil at different levels. And we also blend biochar with different kinds of organic composting material. Again, the purpose is to see the effects on, for example, crop yields. And here you can see differences between the winter wheat crop in the soy beans in the middle and the corn crop. This is located on Scott Wethington's farm, which is our second biochar partnering farm site. Next slide, please. Of course, we're very interested in simulating how biochar would work with a typical row crop cultivation, and this is the location of our biochar evaluation site on privateer farm, and it mimics much more the typical row crop configuration, and in this case, it's an image of our first crop test on winter wheat, and you can see what looks like variations in sort of the greenish tone in the picture, and this was about midway between planting and harvesting of winter wheat in early 2010, and you can already see a change in the green density of the crop mass itself. And we know now that that was due to the incorporation of biochar. Next slide, please. This is a table of that biochar effect on the actual plant mass for soybeans. Again, it's about midway in the soybean test, and you can see to the extreme left that, as expected, no biochar had the least effect. But as you move from left to right on the table, the blue biochar as a standalone amendment certainly has a pronounced effect on generating more soybean biomass or soybean plant density. We obtained this data by taking random samples of the surface plant mass. So there is definitely an effect of increasing mass density due to the biochar, but the effect is even more pronounced when you see the green and the sort of brownish-hued columns with higher application rates of mixing it with biochar, and they definitely had the strongest results in increasing the biochar of the plant mass, that is, the blends of manure with biochar. Next slide, please. Again, this is just one table. These are very preliminary results just of our first year trials. And when you see biochar alone or biochar only in the middle, certainly biochar has a much more of a positive effect on yields than the no biochar or no fertilizer column. And in many cases, biochar alone, if even during the first year, is doing better, so to speak, in terms of increasing yields than the conventional chemical NPK treatment. But as you can see in red with this table, it was the biochar plus turkey litter and biochar plus swine manure compost blends that in this first year or very preliminary data seemingly have the most positive effects for the yields used in our trials. Next slide, please.
Richard, we're running a little bit short on time, and I just wanted to announce that we will extend this webinar a bit for questions until 1:15. Those who are not able to stick around for questions may leave at the end at 1 o'clock.
Great. John, should I end up? Or I think I have two more slides.
Yeah, you'll be able to wrap up by one.
Okay. This is the framework for our strategy of using a whole cycle biochar farming application process, and it sort of gives you an idea of what on-farm biochar farming might look like. In this case, in the upper right corner, we're actually harvesting biomass using wildlife corridors through government-funded conservation program. That is, we're using a conservation program and cycling the woody biomass from creating wildlife corridors, chipping it on site, storing it to sort of drive down the moisture rate from the field to approximately 10%. The plan is to use pyrolysis on the farm, and you can see the two individuals there, then apply it. We've actually used a belt-driven manure spreader to do that. And, of course, our ultimate goal is to transfer what we learn from this to the farmer and create understanding and even persuade the farmer to adopt biochar use. And we need to strengthen that transfer by developing cost-benefit analysis and other tools that we are actually conducting right now. Next slide, please. I just want to sum up. We are going to continue to test biochar on row crops. We've actually added additional areas. We're going to do a new vegetable crop area and test biochar. We also are testing poultry litter source biochar, and we know we would like to vary our feedstocks because in a partnership with USDA's Coastal Soil Lab, we know that other feedstocks might improve the water retention aspect of biochar more so than our pine wood chips source does today. We also are changing, frankly, our attitude, if you will, about strictly portable technologies. And we feel that farmers and biochar as a soil amendment should also consider more centralized, larger scale sources of biochar, even the scale that the earlier presentation presented, which could produce obviously a much larger volume of biochar. And for that, we think that farmers collectively, perhaps by forming cooperatives, could easily work out an agreement and perhaps even use their feedstocks. So that would create a very different technological option for biochar as a soil amendment. John, I'm going to leave it there. Our website is there, and we are certainly interested in welcome ideas, and we can arrange visits to see this biochar demonstration as well. Thank you all.
Thank you so much, Richard and Dan, for both of you sharing your experience and knowledge with us. We did run short of time, and I do want to mention that we will be running to 1:15 if necessary to handle all the questions. However, I recognize we billed this event as ending at 1 o'clock, so if people need to leave, they certainly may do that. At around 1 o'clock. I'd like to conclude, though, before we begin Q&A, just to wrap up, by noting that while biorefineries and biochar are both somewhat pre-commercial technologies, they're not available off the shelf very widely, they are technically well-developed. They are just beginning to penetrate the marketplace, though. And as policies are shaped and implemented to support increased use of biomass for energy, all kinds of energy, including biofuels, I hope that today's briefings can help persuade folks on the call and others, policymakers and stakeholders, to think about carbon-negative bioenergy systems as a smart way to achieve an array of vitally important goals. We've clearly heard today that renewable energy, renewable transportation fuels, and soil fertility are not incompatible goals. I want to thank again both of our presenters for sharing their knowledge and experience, and thank you to the audience for your participation. Courtney, if you would, please begin the question and answers now.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. That was a great presentation, and we will now begin question and answer session. Again, I'd like to draw everyone's attention to the panel on the right-hand side of your screen. Chatting questions, if you would like to ask Dan or Richard specifically, or John Bonnets, please just identify that. The first question, who supplied and or built the pyrolysis reactor? What is its throughput? I'm guessing that is for Dan.
I think that's probably for Richard.
Oh, for Richard, sorry.
Yes, I think you're referring to the pyrolysis unit that we actually were the first adopters and purchasers of that, and that was designed by Biochar Engineering Corporation located in Golden, Golden, Colorado. I think we're seeing some additional slides of other very different low-scale units, and you can see the difference when we call a batch unit and a continuous unit. I think, at least I'm looking at the Adams retort kiln, which you can see the batch firebox. And, of course, the prices, the cost are very different. And if anyone is interested, one of our goals is to test this type of portable equipment on our farm, and I'd be more than happy to talk with people about this scale of technology. That's another batch unit.
And Richard, the second part of that question was throughput on the BEC 1000?
Yes, it's using a pyrolysis type of process, little or no oxygen, and basically the feedstocks are baked, so to speak, at approximately 400 degrees centigrade range to create the biochar. The biochar is armored out.
And the capacity or throughput of the device?
The throughput is approximately 6 parts of biomass to 1 part of feedstock. In our case, we're using pine wood chips. And during a approximately 1 hour run, you can produce ideally 50 pounds of biochar. The unit you're seeing right now, is much lower, for example, and, you know, of about 60 pounds, or I'm sorry, 80 pounds of feedstock, you would get about 15 pounds of biochar during a 1 hour run. It's also much more affordable, and there's no computer hardware, software.
The next question is for Dan. What fraction of feedstock input ends up as char versus other biorefinery products?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
This question is for Dan. What fraction of the feedstock input ends up as char versus the other biorefinery products?
That is a variable. Right now, the systems that we have designed minimize the amount of char we make because that carbon that goes out as char can go out as valuable things like fuels and energy. If in the name of sustainability there is a reason to create more char, we can do that. We can easily dial back the process and reject char so that it can be used. This is a discussion that we've had in the past on how do you want to balance this biorefinery for the best benefit to the region? It's a variable you can alter.
Okay. We're still taking questions. If you have questions, please enter them in the chat panel on the side. Chatted everybody. Okay. Any questions? Okay. A follow-up question to the one that Dan just asked is, can you give sort of a range? If not a specific?
Oh, a range of char?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, typically, if we're less than 1% char in a system that's optimized to utilize the char as much as possible, but we could easily create up to 10% of the biomass coming in, and maybe as high as 15% of the biomass coming in as char.
Pyrolysis, by definition, is heating in the absence of oxygen. Did you add a fuel?
I think that's directed to me. We do not add a fuel. The typically the low scale units, they're using the syngas to sort of self energize the continuous thermal process. The only thing you do at the very, very beginning is that you might, frankly, sort of to get things started, you sort of light your feedstock with a propane gas, in our case, but that's after the process is thermally running. You do not add any exogenous fuel sources. So the percentages are almost like Dan was saying. Most of the process is in the form of gases and liquids, and the the remainder, about 20 to 10%, is the more solid particulate biochar that you can use as a soil amendment. Does that answer? So no, you don't use an outside fuel source.
Well, then he was wondering if that, in that case, if it was gasification.
Well, there's some differences in the at the small scale level, and it's my understanding that the unit we use, it actually integrates physical aspects of pyrolysis as well as gasification. But you know, you don't need the oxygen because you're driving the process with the syngas that's produced from the biomass itself, and then that process separates that, and that's how you get the frankly heavier biochar at the end of the output.
Wonderful. I believe that that's all of the questions that we have right now. This is the final call for questions. Oh. Next question. Are you examining for any presence of heavy metals or various toxins in biochar or the plants produced therefrom?
Yes. As I said, that's part of the whole assessment evaluation process. You definitely look at the composition of the biochar, of course, before you incorporate it into the soil. And in particular, you know, you're looking for any toxic levels of minerals or chemicals that would harm plant growth or contaminate water as it filtrated through the sand. We have not detected anything in the biochars that we have used. We feel that they are very well adapted for potential soil amendment use. And we also are analyzing the plant tissue itself. We do that twice a year during the cultivation and harvesting of the crops that we do. So that's a very important aspect, and we definitely, as a demonstration, are analyzing for those kinds of heavy metals and any other toxics.
Are you expecting any detrimental effects from long-term use of biochar?
Well, you know, we certainly are ready to evaluate both positive and any potential negative effects. You know, biochar as a soil fertility material has been around for thousands of years. We're just doing a very recent sort of technical manufacturing of it. It's been found in tropical soils in Amazonia after it's been in the soil for 2 to 3, even 5,000 years without any negative aspects in terms of the soil conditions there. Contrary, it really improved the long-term soil conditions in those tropical areas where it's been used the longest. I think there's probably more caution needed for the production of biochar in terms of air emissions and those kinds of potential negative effects. But it's too early to tell what all the long-term effects will be. But after all, biochar is mainly stable carbon C. It's approximately 70-80% of that. And so it should have a very positive effect applying that stable carbon to the soil.
Okay. going to be final call for questions. Next question.
Richard.
Could the use of bio...
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, John. Oh, could
no,
the use of biochar reduce the dependence on irrigation?
Yes. Certainly some of the early work with biochar sourced from particular materials shows a definite increase in the soil's water-holding capacity, particularly when those soils are of a sandy composition. And again, that work mainly has been done through our partner, USDA Coastal Soil Labs, located in Florence, South Carolina. So we're actually very excited because of our soil content and the moisture retention challenges that we have, and we think we would like to apply some different sources of feedstock and see how they might improve the water retention aspect in sandy soils. But there's definitely very promising work about improving the water holding capacity of soils through biochar. Again, it depends on the soil matter and the source of the feedstocks.
Okay.
Richard, could you reiterate for us again how it is that biochar actually helps the climate?
Well, we could. It's definitely adding a stable carbon sea source to the soils that will retain that quality over a very, very long period of time. It will not decompose as other very good, for example, plant litter type of compost. So if you've used a carbon negative process to produce the biochar, you're actually increasing over time the carbon content in the soils by adding biochar.
Is it also the case that we have significant carbon being sequestered in the form of the microbes and fungi which are encouraged to grow because of that?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. There's not as much research work done, but we've actually found after approximately 6 months, the soil where we inserted biochar was developing a new microbial growth pattern that had not been in the soil before we incorporated the biochar. So that would be something definitely positive for the nutrient conditioning aspects, and also certainly to help plant growth. And so there is some research on the microbial action increasing in the soil with biochar, and the USDA lab in Florence has told us that seems to be happening on privateer farm.
And is it also true that we have found reductions in emissions of nitrous oxide from farm soils that have had biochar?
Nitric oxide and there's one other greenhouse gas as well. The research shows that we have not looked at those things in our own soil, but yes, there could be benefits in terms of reducing the effects of greenhouse gases. I also didn't mention that we have already seen a slight lowering of the acidic natures of our soil in the biochar added soil content. We've measured compared to our baseline, there's already been a reduction in the pH acid indication in our soils. Of course, they were extremely acidic to begin with.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate all of our presenters, Dan and Richard, and especially John Bonitz. There's been a great presentation, and we appreciate most of all the people that have attended this webinar today and asked such thoughtful questions. We are incredibly excited about our webinar series, as it's a great way to connect with you, our members and supporters, on the critical issues we all care about. This has been our March installment of our monthly webinar series, and we thank you for participating today. If you had a question that didn't get answered, please feel free to send it to info@cleanenergy.org, and we'll be in touch. Also, please visit our website, and you can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook to stay up to date on the most pressing clean energy issues. Again, we thank you for joining us this afternoon, and we hope you have a lovely day.
Thank you, Courtney. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.